Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, November 19, 2013, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the special Courthouse Steps edition of the Practice Group's telephone conference call. On today's call, we'll be discussing the newly argued case, Unite Here versus Mulhall, argued just last week in the Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. And today, we welcome to today's call staff attorney from the NFIB Business Legal Center. He is Mr. Luke Wake. He's a first-time presenter here on our telephone conference call, so we're very happy to have him. He's going to begin by giving us some background on the case, and then he'll discuss the oral argument itself, and then, as always, we'll take questions from the audience. I think his opening remark is going to be something in the order of 15 to 20 minutes, and with that, Mr. Wake, the floor is yours.
Okay, well, thank you for having me here to talk today about the Mulhall case, or Unite Here, Local 355 versus Martin Mulhall. This is one of actually two very important Supreme Court cases this term that deals with an important issue of labor law, the other being Harris versus Quinn, which deals with a First Amendment challenge to Illinois law. But this case, Unite Here, is dealing with the question of whether or not demands from unions and an agreement from an employer to give things like access to company property, information on employee, information such as their home address, personal information about the employees, and an agreement to remain neutral, for the employer to remain neutral on issues of unionization, whether those constitute things of value for the purposes of the Labor Management Relations Act. Now, this is important because Section 302 of the Labor Management Relations Act prohibits unions from demanding and employers from delivering money or, quote, other things of value. So the question really comes down to what are things of value, and are the sort of things that we're talking about here, access to company property, information on employees, and an agreement to remain neutral, do those actually constitute things of value for the purposes of this act, that is? Now, you know, before I get too much into the weeds about how this case came about, I want to, you know, just preface this by saying we do think that this is going to be a game changer in some ways, and I've described this case elsewhere as being probably the most important labor case in decades, and I see Professor Benjamin Sachs from Harvard has been quoted in the New York Times also as referring to this case as probably the most significant labor case in a generation. And the reason is because it's going to decide whether or not what has become over the course of time an accepted union practice is legal. Now, if you're involved with labor law, you know that there are two ways really that you can have a unionization campaign. I mean, there's what a union organizer might describe as the difficult way of campaigning for unionization. And aggressively pushing your agenda of unionizing a specific workforce, and having a secret ballot election which the employer can insist upon if they want, and the employer of course could exercise First Amendment rights to speak up against unionization and to, you know, educate employees about the costs associated with that during the course of that. The other way, and what has become increasingly common and frankly predominant in recent years, is a push for car check voting, and specifically, the union organizers will frequently push to have the union or have the employer agree to allow to bypass the secret ballot election process and instead agree to allow the unions to go through the workforce and have the employees basically vote with these card checks, and of course that's not a secret ballot election, it's a card check, it's simply yes or no on a card basically. And the you know, it's undisputed. All sides agree and recognize that when the unions succeed in using the latter approach, when they can get an employer to agree to allow these sort of car check procedures, that their success rate rise. So they work to negotiate an agreement with an employer, and very commonly we'll seek things in these agreements such as access to company property, so that they can talk to employees about what they want about unionization, and also very commonly they will ask the employer when they may even demand that the employer agree in this basic contract, if you will, that they will hand over information on the employees so that it will be easier for the union to contact them. And then thirdly, the unions often will demand, sort of as a term of these agreements, that the employer will waive its First Amendment rights. They like to call these neutrality agreements, and I would put that in quotation marks because we at NFIB Legal kind of took issue with the idea of this practice, because from our perspective, from the small business perspective, and I think from the perspective of a lot of employers, there is a great potential for extortion. In fact, these so-called corporate campaigns have been, throughout the 1990s, increasingly common, and with them comes, as a number of the amici have noted, particularly in our brief, these campaigns can and often are, to some extent, coercive. There's a real threat that the union will sort of basically apply pressure and threaten, as we would put it, sort of economic war against a business that refuses to go along with that. And along with that, there's always sort of, or there can be anyways, threats to maybe report a business to a regulatory agency or something along those lines, and to put whatever sort of pressure they can on the business to actually sign these agreements. So from our perspective, as we raised in the briefing, and as National Right to Work has alluded to and their role as a respondent in this case, there is a concern in Section 302 about extortionate union practices, and specifically whether or not when a union makes a demand for the sort of things we're talking about, access to company property, which we might suggest is paramount to a demand that an employer waive property rights, the constitutionally protected right to exclude per se, and requirement that they waive the constitutionally protected First Amendment right to oppose unionization, that there are grave concerns with these sort of approaches. Now, throughout the entire history of the National Labor Management Relations Act, these practices have gone essentially unquestioned in the courts. I mean, it's come up before, and as these have become increasingly prevalent, we have begun to see percolating through the courts questions about the legality of these sort of agreements. But until the 11th Circuit's decision in this case, all of the circuits that had addressed the question of whether or not these sort of things constitute things of value under Section 302, they unanimously rejected the idea that there was something illegal with that. And, in fact, that is what happened in the district court here. To give you a little facts on the case before I get into the substance of the Supreme Court decision, this case arises out of the South Florida area, where a gaming company was seeking to basically get in slot machine business, and they struck a deal with Unite Here, which is a union, and basically agreed, pursuant to the deal, again, that they would give access to company property, information on employees, and they would agree to remain neutral on issues of unionization. In exchange for the union's sort of cooperation and support as they sought to essentially lobby for a change in local law which prohibited slot machines. So as they entered into this agreement, and the union moved forward with sort of their end of the deal, if you will, and spent actually about $100,000 on lobbying and campaigning politically for a change in the local ordinance, and effectively so. So once the ordinance was changed, once it became legal to operate this sort of business, they said, okay, well, we've done our duty here. Now that the company moved forward, was beginning to set up shop, the union began to press for the things that they had negotiated for earlier on, access to company employee information and so forth. And for a time, the employer went along with it. But at some point, the employer changed course and actually stopped going along with it, and actually they began to speak against unionization to some extent. At that point, the union initiated, pursuant to a provision of their agreement, they initiated arbitration because the agreement compelled arbitration. So they sought to compel the business to comply with the terms of the agreement through arbitration. And in the meantime, the business went to district court seeking to say that the agreement was illegal under Section 302. At that point, the district court said, no, you've got to go through arbitration. Meanwhile, Martin Muhall, who is an employee of this business and is represented by National Right to Work, sought to raise the same argument, saying that he's concerned, or was concerned, that his business or his workplace might become a union shop, and was specifically concerned about this agreement, that it might make it easier for his company to become unionized. As a result, he raised his concerns in district court, and again, the district court ruled against him. But on appeal in the 11th Circuit, and in patent conflict, really, with the 11th, with the Third Circuit, among other circuits, the 11th Circuit held that, in fact, there may be a cause of action here. There may be a claim, and there was, of course, a dissent. But specifically, the court held that, it held two things. The court said that intangible assistance to a union is not necessarily covered by this act, because the Section 302 prohibits the business from delivering or giving the union these things. And so they said, well, you cannot deliver intangible assets. And instead, they said, but it's possible that the business could give things to the union. And as a result, they said, therefore, the court needs to look at whether or not there was some sort of a payment, some sort of a consideration, a quid pro quo, if you will. So as a result, the 11th Circuit held out the possibility, essentially, that the union might have had some sort of a corrupt influence. They essentially read a scienter requirement into this. Now, of course, the U.S. Supreme Court granted cert, and in the Supreme Court, there was obviously great interest among the labor community. I should note that as the Unite Here sought cert, at the same time, the National Right to Work sought a cross petition for cert, basically trying to get the court to question also whether or not the 11th Circuit erred in holding that intangible things cannot be considered things of value here. The court never really responded to that, but to some extent, the question of whether intangibles are covered by Section 302's prohibition of giving or delivering things of value is still in the background. Now, again, in the Supreme Court, great deal of attention from the unions and whatnot. AFL-CIO basically filed a brief saying essentially that the sky was falling, and that if the court was to accept the interpretation that Martin Muhall is advancing here, that would be essentially the end of industrial peace. And they even went so far as to invoke the employer's First Amendment right to remain neutral on issues of unionization against them, saying essentially that businesses need to be free to sign these agreements. Now, of course, Muhall has always taken a position that, of course, an employer has First Amendment rights to remain neutral, but that's not at issue here. What is at issue is the employer's whether or not an employer can actually sign an agreement that gives the union an enforceable right to enjoin the exercise of First Amendment rights. Now, of course, we filed an amicus brief making the case that, it really is inappropriate for the unions to speak about this as if it was going to be the end of industrial peace, because again, there's great concern over the potential for coercive action on the part of unions, specifically the idea that the unions, by putting pressure on businesses to waive constitutionally protected rights, that there's something wrong with that, and that the court should recognize that. Let's move into the arguments. Arguing for Unite Here was Richard McCracken from San Francisco, and the United States, as amicus, was also allowed to argue on behalf of the petition, on the petitioner's side. Deputy Solicitor General Michael Dibrin argued for the United States, and then, of course, Bill Messenger had a fine argument for respondent. I would say a few issues here. First, Justice Alito and Ginsburg both raised significant concerns, in their mind anyways, over whether or not there was standing in this case at all, because the agreement that that this whole lawsuit was predicated upon had actually expired more than a year ago. And so, you know, there was a real question as to whether or not the case was moot. In fact, the United States, when the United States actually opposed the grant of cert in this case, did so in part because they thought that the fact that the agreement had long ago expired mooted the case, and that it really didn't warrant the court's review. Now, the reason that and Justice Alito was concerned that, you know, there was no imminent injury here. In fact, as you know, as the union, as Unite Here argues, you know, the harm that he's alleging is, you know, only going to come into place if he's forced into a collective bargaining situation, and that requires a number of things to happen here, which we just can't assume, is essentially the tack that they took on standing. You know, the problem with that, and the reason I think the court is ultimately going to decide that there's not really a problem with standing here, but again, sort of reading tea leaves at this juncture. But Unite Here currently, you know, outside of this present lawsuit, they have a pending lawsuit in which they're trying to compel arbitration that would, wherein they're alleging that the employer violated the agreement and that they're actually asking that the agreement be extended for a longer period of time. So, that proceeding is actually stayed. And if this present case, if the Mulhall case is dismissed at that point, the stay would probably be lifted, and Unite Here could move forward. So, to, you know, Justice Alito's concerns, I think Messenger's did a fine job of basically making the point that this is a situation that it remains imminent, because the Unite Here continues to push for the sort of things that they demanded initially in the agreement. In fact, they're currently litigating to have an extension of the agreement. So, but standing remains an issue. Also, there was a little bit of a question in the court raised specifically by Justice Kagan and Ginsburg as to whether or not there's even a private right of action under Section 302 for employees. Now, that's not something that in my view is squarely put before the court. In fact, the Assistant Solicitor General raised that point precisely during his argument, in which he pointed out that historically the courts have accepted this. The 11th Circuit didn't even question whether or not there was a private right of action. Now, Justice Kagan and Ginsburg did suggest that they had doubts as to whether or not if they were to actually consider that question of whether Section 302 creates a private right of action, that they might be willing to say no, but that would require them to go back and sort of reconsider language from an earlier decision, much earlier. But that was from, as Ginsburg pointed out, an earlier time. So I think it unlikely that the case will be caught up and sort of taken off course by the standing or private right of action questions, but they did linger. But as to the merits, I think that the parties are in agreement only on one thing, and that is that Section 302, when it says unions are prohibited from demanding and employers are prohibited from delivering, quote, money or other things of value, they're in agreement that that prohibition applies only with regard to things that are given to to the union or delivered to the union, and not so much about things that the union necessarily does for the employer, which is interesting because if you listen to the argument, a number of the justices took real issue with the fact that in this case the union had actually expended $100,000 in political activities and what looked to be sort of fulfillment of its end of the bargain. And Justice Scalia, for example, suggested that this sounded like a quid pro quo. But, I mean, it wasn't it wasn't Scalia alone who was taking issue with the sort of appearance of a quid pro quo scenario. Even Elena Kagan suggested that that there might be something wrong with that. She said, you know, to her that seems like a bribe. So it did seem like there was concern along different spectrums of the court over whether or not that sort of a quid pro quo would actually violate Section 302. But as for whether or not it's actually a thing of value, interestingly, it seems like across all spectrums, there was essentially, although subject to debate as to how far you can carry this and how far you can view, for example, a license as a thing to value. Most of the panel or most of the court seemed willing to recognize that sort of in terms of general usage and in terms of a broad a consistent application of legal theory in other areas of the law, that something like an agreement to give access to private property would constitute a thing of value. And the debate really in the Supreme Court during this oral argument was whether or not there's a reason to sort of set that sort of conventional legal understanding aside, because of course, as the United States points out in numerous statutes, we use the phrase, things of value, and generally in the law that's given a sort of broad application to cover intangibles as well as tangibles, and frankly when it comes to enforcement actions, the United States generally does like to take a very broad view. But of course this is a special area; it's labor law, and they've taken a different tact. So the question here is whether, setting aside the sort of plain ordinary reading of that language, which if set aside, the United States certainly concedes, and probably even the petitioner would concede that if just looked in isolation, it may very well cover these things. But they argue that we need to look at a whole host of things, including the broad framework for the statutory regime that we govern labor law under, and look at that point to limit application of Section 302, because other areas of labor law, do talk about the importance of encouraging sort of peaceful agreements and things like that, and they do set forward a framework for addressing that. And so the argument on the one hand is that the court has a responsibility to divine congressional intent based on the language, structure, and history of the act, and starting from the proposition that voluntary recognition agreements are sort of a goal of the NLRA and are actually a favored element. So says the United States, for example. They say that it would, essentially wreak havoc. It would essentially make it impossible for these agreements to unfold. Now, Bill Messenger, in his argument, did a fine job of basically making the point that, well, whereas in the past, in other cases where the court has sort of read an express limitation into a law, by virtue of the fact that there's a conflict, if we were to give too literal of an application to this provision, it would conflict with other statutory provisions that seemingly allow the sort of conduct that's at issue. And here he's saying, well, there is no conflict. Here the sort of things that that are being asked for, that we're quibbling over, are not expressly authorized under other portions of labor law, and in fact there are some exceptions to the things that that Section 302 prohibits, and that they are specifically spelled out in statutes. So essentially, the structure of his argument is that what is explicitly authorized in federal law for unions to ask for and to push for are not going to be the sort of things that are prohibited by Section 302 because there's an explicit authorization. Again, the thrust of Justice Breyer's concerns, for example, with that is that, you know, whereas Mulhall is concerned that, you know, interpreting Section 302 as not to cover things like a demand for access to company property would create a gaping hole in the act. Justice Breyer essentially, you know, posited with a series of questions, one can infer that he's concerned that in order to be consistent with other aspects of labor law, you just have to read an implicit limitation such that the normal ordinary use of the term other things of value has to be inferentially limited. So this really is, and this really is, I suppose, my concluding remark before we go over to question and answer, but this really is a case where the court is going to have to choose between what would seem to be a very logical, clear, plain reading of Section 302, or an also potentially logically compelling argument that you know, based on structure and other things, that there has to be inferred an implicit limitation. And, you know, we obviously argued, along with petitioner, that we need to apply the plain language, and in part, as I suggested as amicus, it's important to do so because it's reasonable to assume that Congress would have intended the act to be interpreted in a manner that would actually protect constitutional rights and would avoid issues of extortion. But be that as it may, it does seem that we have a very divided court here, and with that, I'll turn it over for questions.
Very good. Thank you so much. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for our expert, you'll need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, we need you to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Star button and then pound button. And while we're waiting to see who rings in here, let me make an announcement that our National Lawyers Convention video, even more of it, is available now at our website than was yesterday. Our website is www.fed-soc.org. It's www.fed-soc.org. Much of the video, I think all of the video now is available, including the interview with Justice Clarence Thomas that took place last Thursday evening at our annual dinner. In terms of upcoming Teleform conference calls, tomorrow at 2 p.m. we'll be discussing civil asset forfeiture. It's something that's on a lot of people's minds. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. at the same number, 2 p.m. Eastern time. It's quite possible we'll be adding another call later in the week, but for that and a schedule of other upcoming calls, you should also check our website. We have one caller on the line with a question, and then our lines will be open. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone, and now let's go to our first caller. Go ahead, caller. You might have muted your own telephone. I'm not sure.
Right. I did mute my own call. Okay. The union is prohibited from giving anything to the company in return for anything the union does. There's total non-freedom to contract here. Is that what the statute says?
Well, that's a good point. There is, and the unions raise freedom of contract as a concern of particularly some conservative scholars, and in fact that is ordinarily, I think it would be rather curious for example, you know, Cato Institute and NFIP Legal Center to be filing on in a brief where advocating for a federal prohibition on a certain sort of contract, but specifically, I think the way I would describe it, because it is that the what is being asked of the employer in this situation, what they're being asked to hand over, at least in part, is subject to a potential
abuse
or extortion for abuse,
yeah.
Exactly, and that was a continuing sort of concern that was echoed even among some of the more liberal justices in this case about the appearance of a quid pro quo. So while you're correct that on one level I one might say, well, businesses would like to retain the prerogative to enter into these sort of agreements. I mean, I think speaking from sort of a free market perspective, one would ask sort of the first question, well, you know, are we really working in a free market setting in the first place, where we have these sort of unionization, you know, this sort of institutional labor law thrust upon employers? But be that as it may, the argument essentially that we put forward in our amicus was that there, you know, as important as we generally do think freedom of contract is, and we certainly do think it's important, but that where there is potential for, you know, this sort of quid pro quo abuse, extortion, if you will, to put coercive pressure on businesses to waive protected constitutional rights, specifically, you know, the right to free speech, the property right to protect, to exclude the public from their property, that the potential for abuse is something that Congress was legitimately concerned about, and is acting, in our view, you know, appropriately, and it would be therefore appropriate to interpret and reasonable to interpret the statute in a way that would foreclose that sort of extortionate behavior.
I agree that the union is often the union management often has a different interest than their membership. And in fact, I've heard of elections being stolen in the law firm of the union by miscounting the ballots in order to keep the incumbent union officials in power.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of thing happens, and that would be something to try to safeguard against it. But a narrower way to safeguard it would be to require any such quid pro quo to be announced to the union membership. I mean, here it seems this is not a bad deal. The company gets to, if I understand it, the company gets to open a casino, and then the union benefits because the company's going to have employees in this casino, and so the union does the lobbying, enabling the entire enterprise to proceed, and yet they're not allowed to receive anything in return.
Well, the union certainly put forward, and in the United States as well, but mostly the union tried to emphasize that this is, you know, these things are mutually beneficial for the employer and the employee. Again, I think that's a proposition that we would question, especially from the small business community, because the fact that, you know, especially when we're talking about smaller companies, they don't have the resources to fight back, and so when they're faced with sort of a shock and awe campaign where a union is threatening essentially economic war, you know, the small business owner really doesn't have the capacity to push back and to effectively defend its rights. And so from our perspective, that there's a real concern about these unions mounting that sort of pressure on a business to waive what are really constitutional rights. But to your other point, there are indeed, I think, an important distinction between relevant throughout this case as to whether or not the union is acting truly in the interest of its employees or whether it's acting in its institutional interests. And that really gets to the heart of it, because the unions would like us to think of this case in the Section 302 as prohibiting only the sort of essentially bribes that employers might do to sort of corrupt a union official. But we maintain, and I think rightfully so, that Section 302 should also be understood as prohibiting the union from making demands that advance its institutional interests. In other words, there should be a concern with the union making demands that simply make it easier for the union to accomplish its goals of unionization, which is self-interested goals, as opposed to a request for something that specifically actually will affirmatively benefit an employee.
Once again, if you have a question, our lines are open at this point. You need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller. We have one caller with a question, and then our lines are open. Again, if you'd like to join, the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Hi, this is Will Trackman out in Denver. There's an old FEC opinion involving collective bargaining and the establishment of a payroll deduction system that says, well, the employer can't provide as part of the CBA a free payroll deduction system because that would be an improper political contribution. I'm not sure that campaign law is still good after some recent campaign finance cases, but what about Section 302? What's your opinion on an employer saying, we'll go ahead and set up a free payroll deduction system for your PAC, and it's part of a CBA. We just want some good feelings on your part, and you don't have to pay for it. Would that be a thing of value in your mind?
Well, first of all, Justice Scalia did have a line of questions during oral arguments about, whether or not, it made sense to look at things that were subject to a collective bargaining agreement, and assuming that it's acceptable for the purpose of a collective bargaining agreement, is there something wrong, with asking an employer to give those sort of things in one of these initial agreements where the business is simply agreeing to, remain neutral on issues of unionization and so forth? So before we get to the collective bargaining agreement, is there something wrong with a union asking for those sorts of things? And I think he seemed satisfied as to the idea that if it's specifically authorized in other portions of labor law to ask for those sorts of things in the course of a collective bargaining agreement, that's all well and good, and if they're specifically authorized to do something for those purposes, that they're not necessarily precluded from doing that under Section 302. I think it would really come down to whether or not what was being demanded actually advances the institutional interest of the union or specifically the interest of the employee, because I think, barring some other affirmative prohibition elsewhere in labor law, but assuming that there's no other affirmative prohibition on that in labor law, given that what we're talking about here is actually tailored towards giving an affirmative benefit specifically to the employee, that would probably not be covered by the prohibition on the employer giving something of value to the union, because I think that language is relevant when it says that the prohibition concerns things that flow to the union specifically, as opposed to things that flow, benefits that affirmatively flow to the employee.
Once again, if you have a question for our expert, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We still have another question pending, then our lines are open. Let's go to our next caller.
Thank you, Mr. Wake, for that presentation. This is Matt Muggeridge. My question has to do with the government's argument at oral arguments, which I attended and with which I was sort of unimpressed, really. And they seemed, I guess it was the Deputy Solicitor General, seemed to like give away a lot of the arguments that might have been made and stick to the point that, well, this is how it's done, and there's 5,000 NLRB cases which say this is okay. And that, I was wondering what your impression on the what seemed to me a quite an unhelpful assist there by the government to the union's case.
Right. Well, that argument was essentially an extension of the same argument that was raised during the briefing. The government and the union, for that matter, you know, again, they raise many arguments about how the sky is going to fall if the court holds Section 302 is prohibiting the sort of things that were demanded in this case. But they and they, you know, make a great deal of hay, if you will, over the fact that this is common practice. It's very well established, but and the fact that no court had previously struck any sort of agreement along these lines down. But of course, that's because this is the first time. That's why this is a question of first impression in the Supreme Court. You know, you cannot base from the fact that no court has ever done this. You cannot draw a negative inference, you cannot draw the inference that it's therefore constitutional or therefore legal, based on the observation that it's always been done. And for that matter, you know, there is some disagreement among the parties about when these sort of unionization campaigns became prevalent and where this became a common practice for the unions to begin, you know, making these sort of demands on employers. But on the one side, the unions would like to say that this began long ago in the 1970s and so on. But there's actually authority on both sides of the fence here. But in our view, it became increasingly predominant in the 1990s. And so it really is not surprising that this issue of whether or not these sort of demands or these sort of agreements are in violation of Section 302. It makes sense that they are only in the last few years percolating through the courts. But in any event, I mean, this is not the first time that the United States, in particular, has sort of rested its hat on the fact that there's common practice. I mean, you look at, for example, the recess appointment cases that are that's in the Supreme Court right now, and a large part of the government's argument there is hanging its hat on the idea that, well, presidents have been taking this sort of action for a long time. That doesn't make it constitutional. And in the same way, I would say, well, just because the unions have been engaged in this practice for a long time and the lower courts had never before struck something down doesn't make it legal. But in any event, I agree that was not the most forceful argument. Really, the most forceful argument from the United States, and frankly, I would say that the United States probably raised the most forceful argument on the union side of the coin, is the notion that just in order to read federal labor law in a consistent manner, in a manner that sort of still advances the general purpose of promoting collective bargaining, promoting industrial peace, that it makes sense to sort of interpret this provision a little more narrowly than we would otherwise. Now, of course, that gets into issues of your legal philosophy and to what extent you want to, entertain that sort of inferential limitation without a firm statutory or textual basis. I would dispute that, but I certainly wouldn't hang my hat if I were them on the notion that unions have been doing this for a long time.
Thanks.
Once again, if you have a question for our expert, our lines are open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We still have a few minutes left. Make this the last call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Okay. Well, Mr. Wake, it looks like you've exhausted the questions from the audience, but let me give you a few minutes to express any final thoughts you might have if you want to wrap up.
Okay. Well, I... just in terms of reading tea leaves, I mean, this is always difficult, and one can only assume, you know, where the court will go from
here. Hey, how are you doing?
But it appears we have got someone else in the background there. But in any event, I would say that it's very difficult to say exactly what's going to happen here, because on the one hand, Justice Kennedy, you know, acknowledged very early on the argument that he thought there was substantial force to the union's argument here. But then he had reservations, and specifically with regard to this idea of quid pro quo. So to the extent that people always think Kennedy's the proverbial swing vote, you know, that may be. Now, obviously, Breyer showed his hands. But, you know, I think actually the real surprise here was with Justice Elena Kagan, you know, and so I think it really could potentially hang on her to some extent, because you know she suggests on the one hand that she's inclined to reject Muhal's interpretation. She said, you know, for example, I would have thought that the premises and policies of labor laws are to encourage you know a wide variety of employer-employee agreements, and you know that. There's something wrong with inferring that there's such a strong limitation in Section 302 that it would prohibit an employer from agreeing to give anything that's not specifically authorized elsewhere in the law. She took issue with that, and said that it doesn't really seem to be the most natural common sense reading of labor law in a homogeneous manner. But then at the same time, she said, you know, but this $100,000 that the unions was willing to spend on the political campaign, she found that troubling. She said, you know, because it seems to her, like a bribe. So if those sort of concerns are, you know, predominant, so important in you know, Elena Kagan's mind, and for that matter, I mean, Sotomayor even gave some suggestions that she was skeptical about a quid pro quo in that light. It could be that we have less of a split than one might conventionally think. However, you know, it remains to be seen because at the end of the day, we've ultimately got to wait until probably June. So those are my thoughts, and I'm happy to entertain any questions if anyone wants to contact me otherwise.
Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, Mr. Wake, let me thank you for a great presentation and for obviously taking the time to check in on the oral argument and be with us here today. I certainly appreciate it. To our audience, I encourage you to check our website for videos of the National Lawyers Convention, and I invite you to join us for our telephone conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.